This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We start our weekly news review with a look at the possible change in status for Hamilton County related to warnings about the spread of COVID-19. Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich is with us now on Zoom. Chris, welcome back to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, man. What are we seeing in this county right now? Why the sudden sense of urgency with the case count?
Well, it's not just the case count. The hospitalizations, of course, are kind of the main indicator as to how bad the coronavirus is spreading in Hamilton County. We've been red for a few weeks now. At this point, we're two factors away. If we test positive, or not test positive, if we hit those two other factors, we'll go to purple. Hospitalizations are at an all-time high for the coronavirus pandemic overall since March. So those are the main concerns. I mean, right now they've got about 231 people in the hospital. Right now, 52 people in intensive care units. These were the numbers that we were given earlier this week about the coronavirus. So there's a lot of concern about what's going on in the region right now.
And that's just in Hamilton County, we should note.
Well, the 231 number is region-wide. That's a region-wide hospitalization number. And Hamilton County is up as well, though maybe not as much as when you look at the overall county.
So how do they measure Hamilton County then? If this is a region-wide thing, why are we focusing on Hamilton County?
I mean, I think we're focusing on all the counties. I mean, all, you know, the counties around us are general, counties around Hamilton County are red. The Hamilton County briefing is probably the most informative one that we hear every week. And so I think that's kind of, you know, why the focus is here.
And, but again, I mean, we're talking about it's Hamilton County that faces possibly changing from red to purple, which is the highest level to warn. And so I guess I just want to get clarity on that. If we're talking about 231 patients admitted to the hospital, along with 52 people in ICU, that's according to data provided by the Health Collaborative. What numbers are they looking at in Hamilton County? I mean, I guess would that suggest that a chunk of those numbers are in this county?
Right. I don't know what the breakout is of Hamilton County at the moment, but yeah, I mean there are a chunk of them, a big chunk that are from Hamilton County. I mean, as you know, most of the population is here. Well, not most of the population, but 800,000 of the 2.1 million who live in the region are in Hamilton County. So it's the most dense county, and it's that kind of been true throughout the pandemic that, you know, Hamilton County has kind of been an early indicator, a canary in a coal mine.
We're talking with Chris Wetterich, reporter and columnist at the Cincinnati Business Courier. So, Chris, what do we know about purple status? If the state does redesignate the county from red to purple, a higher level, what do we know about what that means?
That's a big question. So the contention is that, purple is the worst. So what does that mean in terms of, you know, do we see more restrictions? So far, the governor has not actually said, you know, what he might do with that. He has kind of floated the notion that, in-person school could be at risk if the county goes to purple, or if any county goes to purple. And so that's obviously a serious concern. I know a lot of parents have, you know, feeling a little bit of relief to have their kids at least part of the time back in school. So that's one thing that he mentioned. As far as the reason why the spread is going up, they've basically said, you know, the reason is people are going, you know, over to gatherings at their friends and family's house, or maybe they're attending a large gathering, a wedding, a funeral, or something like that. And it's indoors now because the weather's getting colder. And they believe that is the reason that, we're seeing so much increased spread. They broke out some of that earlier this week, and you kind of saw that reflected in their numbers. We still have a lot of discussion about, you know, why are bars open? Why are, restaurants open and that kind of thing? I asked specifically whether there, you know, is evidence that spread is at bars and restaurants. And, you know, they basically contend that generally it is not starting there, that it doesn't originate there, that it originates with these small gatherings at people's homes or, you know, where they're not in a public setting.
I spoke with Governor Andy Beshear on the Kentucky side just this week, and he said the same thing. They're finding in Kentucky that it's private events at the home, family gatherings, funerals, weddings, and that sort of thing that is leading this spike. And to your point about the weather, we heard in Thursday night's presidential debate, Joe Biden sort of making like a Game of Thrones-esque warning that we're facing a dark winter ahead as the temperature changes. So we've got a lot that we'll be watching in the coming weeks and months. And the other thing that's still going on, in addition to this increase, Chris, is the economic impact, obviously. And a lot of businesses still struggling due to restrictions placed on them to keep crowds at a minimum, if possible. And the city of Cincinnati, Mayor John Cranley announced a partnership with the regional chamber to unveil this multimillion dollar stimulus for restaurants. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, they're going to take about, I think it's $4 million from the Federal CARES Act. This is money that the city has received through the Federal Coronavirus Aid Act. And what they're going to do is basically give grants to restaurants, $10,000, $15,000, and they're going to allow them to basically kind of use that for whatever they need to prepare for the winter. When I asked the restaurant owners what they plan to do with it, you know, some people said, look, we've already invested tens of thousands, many, many dollars in, you know, plexiglass and trying to make our restaurant safer. So they kind of see it as reimbursement for that, maybe buying some heaters to the extent that they can have outdoor dining. There's all kinds of potential expenses that they could pay for with this. It's not a silver bullet, they said. It's not going to, solve all the problems, but they appreciate it. They think it's a good program, and they kind of recognize that the mayor has made a special effort here to help them, you know, keep going. When the Congress passed the aid for small businesses for the coronavirus, this was a really difficult situation for the restaurant owners to try to decide whether to go to loans and their, you know, loans that can turn into grants, the PPP program, as they call it, because they were not necessarily able to bring people back to work right away because of the closure kind of mandated by the state of indoor dining. So they need every penny that they can get, and they're appreciative of this program.
There are a lot of industries, a lot of sectors in our economy that have been adversely impacted by the response to COVID-19, not the least of which is the arts. And we heard just this week that Cincinnati Shakespeare Company and Playhouse in the Park are canceling their Christmas shows and delaying the start of their season next year. And we also heard this week, in an effort to support that, Hamilton County is launching an aid program specifically for arts organizations. What can you tell us about that one, Chris?
Yeah, it's a $3 million program, and it's also money that is kind of being repurposed from the CARES Act money. So this is again the Congress's attempt to help state and local governments, and they've taken a look at it and tried to distribute that money. Hamilton County has a lot of these types of programs. They have one for small businesses. They have one for nonprofits. This is the first time they've kind of unveiled one for the arts. So it's about $3.5 million, and it's aimed at helping the 10,000 people or so that are employed in the arts across the region. And so they're going to distribute grants, and I believe that people can get up to, I think it's five. The minimum request is 5,000, and large organizations can get up to 100,000. So these are some major grants in terms of the dollar amount for them. And this is another thing where people are able to use it to try to kind of stay afloat.
And that's such a striking number. 10,000 people work in the arts industry throughout this region, with the bulk being, of course, in Hamilton County. So it'll be interesting to see how they manage to survive with some of this support. Obviously, COVID-19, not just impacting the economy and people's health. It's a big issue on the campaign trail, and the campaign trail ran through Cincinnati again this week. Vice President Mike Pence paid a visit to Lunkin Airport. I know you weren't there in person, but you did cover this remotely, as journalists are doing a lot of events these days. What did you hear from Vice President Pence at Lunkin Airport?
You know, it was really kind of the standard stump speech that we hear from presidents and vice presidents, although President Trump doesn't really do the whole stump speech thing very much. But Vice President Pence, very disciplined, very on message. Really, his message was, you know, look at the pre-COVID-19 economy. We can do that again if you reelect you know, him and President Trump. And, you know, he touched on a number of economic issues. He ripped into Biden for proposing a repeal of the Trump tax cuts. Of course, Biden has proposed repealing the tax cuts for those that make more than $400,000. You know, he had some pretty choice lines. He said it's a choice between the Trump recovery and a Biden depression. He has the same message that the president has, which is that Biden is a kind of a Trojan horse for the radical left. So it was kind of a standard stump speech. He did mention some of our local candidates, including Congressman Steve Chabot, who is in a very tight race with Kate Schroeder, the Democrat, urging people to vote for Chabot, of course. Other than the greatest hits from that campaign, that was about it.
And so you are with the Business Courier, of course. So in addition to just general news reporting as it impacts our community, you do have a focus on business. And you profiled the list of the top donors from the business community to both Vice President Joe Biden and President Trump in their campaign against each other. What struck you among those? Anything unusual among those lists of big donors to the two candidates?
You know, the thing that struck me as unusual, particularly about the Republican donors, is that the major players in the Cincinnati Business Committee, which is the large group of business, well, it's not very large, it's kind of an exclusive group of CEOs of the largest companies in town, the people that we typically see donate to Republicans, like Craig Lindner and Carl Lindner III at American Financial, or Bob Casolini, who owns the Cincinnati Reds, as well as the Casolini companies, we could not find any contribution directly to the president's campaign committees or the associated committees. Now, they have donated a ton to other Republican candidates, and we'll be doing a story about that later this month. But the top people to Trump's campaign, what we were able to find was actually a couple that owns Middletown Tube Works in Middletown, which you probably don't hear very much about. They donated more than $85,000 to Trump's campaign committees. Some other notable names on there: Mike Brown, the owner of the Bengals, he finished fourth. And Bill Butler, the developer from Northern Kentucky, as well as Michael Valentine and John Mocker, a member of the CVG board, they were kind of tied for fifth. So there were some interesting names on it, but the prominent names that you associate with Republican donors weren't necessarily giving a lot to Trump directly.
And on the Democratic side, anything strike you there?
Yeah, I mean, this was another one where, you know, the top Democratic donor in town, generally regarded as, one of the top people, is Dick Rosenthal. And you typically see John Pepper, the former CEO of P&G. They're not at the top of this list, although John Pepper did give directly to Biden. The top donor was Jenny Rosenthal, who is, of course, the daughter of Dick Rosenthal. She gave $55,000 to the Biden campaign and its associated committees. So a little bit, you know, some surprising things, some surprising people at the top of these lists.
Well, let's see if we can get into that salary range sometime, Chris, once we're out of journalism, I suppose. Chris Wetter.
We'll go into manufacturing like Jay Hanselman. That's where we're going to really make the money, Michael.
No, I'm so sad. I'd hope that we'd be able to get both of you on again sometime. Obviously, Jay Hanselman, RJ Hanselman here at VXU, is leaving us at the end of next week. So maybe we'll be able to have a little segment.
Yeah,
get the band back together before we say goodbye to Jay. So have a little fun there. Chris Wetter from the Business Courier, always appreciate your perspective and the time that you give us. Thanks so much for being with us on this Friday.
Thank you.
And Hamilton County's COVID situation has surrounding counties paying attention as they also see a spike in their cases. WKRC-TV reporter James Pilcher, he's with us now on Zoom to talk about that. James, welcome back. Do we have James Pilcher with us? Oh, that's okay.
I was muted.
You know,
I apologize.
James, it's okay. I think all of us are familiar with Zoom situations now, and I think you need to unmute yourself is probably the phrase of the year. So no problem at all. We're glad to have you with us. And you've been...
I was waiting for you to go to break, so I apologize.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should let you know we were transitioning. We just can't wait to get to you, James. We just couldn't wait any longer. But you've been in Kentucky and Indiana talking to health officials. We've been talking about Hamilton County and the threat they face of turning purple, which is the highest level of warning as it relates to COVID spread in Ohio. But what are you finding over in Dearborn County? What are you finding in Northern Kentucky?
Well, both Dearborn and Ohio counties are both among only four counties in Indiana that are in the red, which is their highest status. So their rates are, Dearborn has 226 cases per 100,000. So for, by comparison, anything over 100 by the CDC is considered a major spread, right? So an Ohio county is 476 per 100,000. So Dearborn and Ohio counties in Southeast Indiana are already dealing with this. I spoke with the top health official in Dearborn County, and he did say some of it might be spreading from Hamilton County, but they've got their own issues. It's just, you know, this virus knows no borders or state lines. So that's the case there. And then just this morning, I spoke with Dr. Lynn Sadler, who is the top official at the Northern Kentucky Health Department. And they are finally now saying, yes, we're in the midst of a new surge in Northern Kentucky, and that when all the numbers are in, we are looking at the highest week in terms of total new cases since the pandemic began last week. And then this week might actually exceed that. Governor Beshear actually noted that there were like 50 new cases in Boone County in one day earlier this week, and said, hey, it's right next to Hamilton County. People are going across, going to work, bringing it back, all of those things. And obviously, you know, like I said, the virus knows no boundaries. So yeah, there is a major concern. The hospitalizations, I talked to St. Elizabeth. They said that they've actually had a double. Right now they have double the amount of hospitalizations than they did a month ago. They still have plenty of room, but they are looking at renewing their surge plan in case things do get worse. Hospitalizations and deaths are trailing indicators. They're not as bad in those counties as they are in Hamilton County right now, but the local officials are preparing for the worst.
A couple things there, James. I mean, Governor Beshear consistently reminded us throughout the summer when we first started to see a spike on the Kentucky side that deaths follow the spikes, right, by usually a couple of weeks. So that could still be true down the road. And the other thing that I heard you mention that really struck me was that St. Elizabeth is revisiting its surge plan, which is something that, you know, all of the healthcare, I guess, operations were preparing for back in March when we didn't know exactly what to expect. Governor Beshear announced earlier this week that the state government is revisiting its surge plan, looking at hotel rooms,
looking at setting up field hospitals in hotels and state parks. So, I mean, that would be the extreme in just in case kind of example. But yeah, they are renewing those plans. You know, I listened to that press conference that day when he said that, and that really struck me too.
Yeah, it's like we're back at the beginning almost, that we're hearing a lot of the same warnings. And we had that dip in the late spring and early summer where we flatten the curve and we're able to start going out. And it's interesting that, you know, there's suggestion maybe you're going into Hamilton County, which has a higher case count and a more densely populated area, and then possibly taking it back. But it does sound like government and health officials on every side of the river around our tri-state region, they're citing the local gatherings, the small gatherings, as sort of the catalyst for this.
Yeah, and I'm looking at, you know, I gave you those numbers for Southeast Indiana, for example. I'm looking at Northern Kentucky right now. By way of example, Boone County has 15 new cases in the last week per 100,000. So that compares to the 200 per 100,000 that you're seeing. So the spread isn't as wide or as fast. But Lynn Sadler said it is getting faster. You know, a month ago, those three counties were in the yellow, Boone, Kent, and Campbell. Now they're in the orange, and they're creeping up towards red, which is anything above 25 per 100,000. So yeah, I mean, it is, and that's what she said. That's what Dr. Sadler said, is that, yeah, we can talk about it coming across the river, but most of this is because people are congregating, getting together, what Chris said earlier. And it's not coming from congregate living. They have had a few minor outbreaks in some nursing homes, but this is community spread. This is being spread throughout these communities. So that, you know, that they are concerned. And I think her analogy, which I'll put on the air tonight at 5, is that, you know, even if your house isn't on fire or you have a small kitchen fire, it doesn't mean you stop it and let the house burn down. So, you know, they're trying to put a stop to this now. I do want to get into, at the same token, I did talk to Kentucky Senator Rand Paul about this yesterday. And he has a completely different perspective and strategy. He said we should open everything up, that because the death rate is so low, yeah, people will get it. Maybe people get sick, but we need to reopen the economy and create herd immunity until the virus, until we have a vaccine.
And we should remember, he contracted this virus at one point.
Yes, he did. And now he feels like he is immune and he's not going to spread it, so we won't wear a mask either. So, you know, he has a different point of view. I'm not saying I agree or disagree with it. I just wanted to put it out there that, you know, there are people who are pushing back on this idea that, oh, it's getting worse, we need to shut it down again. And that he points his finger directly at Andy Beshear, saying he's got too much power.
Yeah. And we talked to Congressman Thomas Massie, the Republican who represents Northern Kentucky, who also, I don't know if he knew exactly when he had COVID. He suspects it was in January. He confirmed that he must have had it through the antibody test that is given. He told us here at WVXU sort of the same thing. He is in favor of proceeding with herd immunity. There's a lot of analysis of that that suggests we'd have over 2 million deaths in this country in order for our population to achieve that. But that is a conversation they want to have. In addition to talking to Rand Paul, you've talked to a couple of other candidates and politicians who are also addressing COVID-19 in their campaign. And that's Senator Mitch McConnell and his opponent, Amy McGrath. What are they doing here in these final days? I know you analyzed some ads that they put out and whether they both are stretching the truth.
I did. My second ad check, my fact check of their ads was about one that they lobbed at each other over the summer. Before I get into that, I'll get into what they each have to say. So I talked to Senator McConnell on Tuesday before his stimulus bill came to the floor yesterday. Now, I wasn't able to ask him campaign questions because it was through his official office. It wasn't a campaign interview. It was more of a interview as an official congressman or senator. But I did ask him specifically about the stimulus and where it stood and everything else. He brought a $550 billion bill to the floor yesterday. I think 52 out of 53 Republicans voted for it, but it needed 60 votes to pass. And it didn't get that because the Democrats didn't agree with it. They want more. In the meantime, that night after I interviewed him, a couple of national media outlets came out with reports saying that McConnell behind the scenes was actually trying to get the White House not to negotiate with Nancy Pelosi in Congress about creating a bigger deal that would include stimulus checks to individuals. So I didn't get a chance to ask him about that because it happened afterwards. But then they did bring that bill to the floor. And now they're saying they're still going to try and negotiate. They don't know whether they'll get anything done before Election Day. You know, the Washington Post and New York Times both reported that McConnell wanted to kill it because he didn't want the Democrats to get a win this close to the election. As you may know, he's well ahead in the polls here, but there are other senators like Lindsey Graham. There's a tough fight in Arizona that any little thing could flip the Senate on him. And then on Wednesday, 5 minutes from my house here in the heart of GOP country in Boone County, Amy McGrath held a stump speech, get out the vote rally at a local park, and I spent 10 minutes with her.
She's been coming to Northern Kentucky a lot in recent
years.
Yeah,
she has, and which is kind of interesting because, as you know, Northern Kentucky is traditionally pretty red and pretty Republican, but she thinks that she can shore up the hometown vote. She has been playing up the suburban mom angle quite a bit in her ads. She's actually turned an ad, that line that McConnell said at her debate, saying, "She's a mom, she's a Marine, and I've been there too long." That's her ad. That's her whole campaign. And they actually turned it. Yeah, that's the ad. That's that. I saw signs saying that at her rally. You know, her take is that, you know, McConnell is the roadblock in all of this, that there's so many bills sitting on his desk. I will say that I did ask McConnell specifically because when he was in Northern Kentucky in July, he said, "I'm going to wait. I'm just going to wait and see if things need to get worse. I'm not going to do anything on stimulus." And at the meantime, the Democrats had already passed something. And so it did sit for a couple months. And now he's saying, "Well, I got tired of waiting and I'm trying to take, I've always been involved in the negotiations." Well, McGrath is trying to make political hay out of that, saying he's the stopgap. He's the roadblock in all of this.
And we're talking with James Pilcher from WKRC-TV. James, we've got about a minute left. You profiled a complicated matter, Kentucky voting on a constitutional amendment, as we do from time to time in the Bluegrass State. This one, Amendment 2, related to the judicial system. Can you quickly explain that to us as if we were in an elevator together and had three floors to explain?
Okay. It will extend the length of terms for Commonwealth attorneys from 6 years to 8 years. Those are the lead prosecutors in each county. It will extend the terms of district judges, which are the lower courts, but they see more people. They handle evictions, DUIs, misdemeanor criminal cases, and in many cases, felony bond hearings, from 4 to 8 years. And it would require those judges to have 8 years of experience versus 2 years of experience. Nobody argues the last point isn't a good thing. What the problem is that some people, including John Schickel, the state senator who voted against putting this on the ballot, is that it doesn't give enough accountability, that 8 years is too long for a judge to be in there, and that 8 years is way too long for a prosecutor to be in office before they have to face the public for a vote. So that's basically the argument for and against. The reason they really want to do this is to match up all the terms so they can redistrict the entire state and reallocate the assets to where they need to go. So they're saying they need to do it to redistrict, but there's arguments about transparency and accountability.
That's James Pilcher. He will have more on television this evening, speaking with Dr. Lynn Sandler of the Northern Kentucky Health Department. James Pilcher from WKRC-TV. We do always appreciate the time that you give us, James.
Hey, no worries. Michael, thanks for having me. Always enjoy it.
Indeed. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our weekly news review now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. He joins us via Zoom. Cameron, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. I know that you and your colleague at the Inquirer, Madeline Mitchell, just posted an updated article just moments ago at Cincinnati.com about this investigation into an Elmwood Place officer-involved shooting. What is the latest on this matter? What can you tell us about it?
Well, the reason for the story was actually just to kind of refresh it and keep it in the news cycle as this investigation continues through the weekend. So far, there are some major questions about the incident that remain unanswered. As the police officers, the police department there in Elmwood Place has said, there is no footage of the incident, which is becoming increasingly uncommon when these incidents occur. Cincinnati police always seem to have body camera video, dash camera video. Many of the surrounding agencies have body camera and dash camera video of these incidents that sort of gives people at least a little bit of a firsthand insight into what occurred, but doesn't seem to be the case here. The other major questions that remain unanswered is why Rodney Barnes was pulled over in Elmwood Place. We do know that he was wanted following a conviction for aggravated robbery, which is kind of a strange turn of phrase. But from what we understand, he was convicted in court on an aggravated robbery charge. He was later taken to a psychiatric unit at a local hospital and was able to walk away from that unit. He was listed as a missing person. The Hamilton County Sheriff's Office confirmed that he was, you know, they were searching for him after he walked away from this unit. We don't know if the reason that he was pulled over was due to him being wanted or if there was some other situation happening that prompted the traffic stop. We were told by the police chief there that there was an exchange of gunfire, which suggests that the man who was shot by the officer was armed, but very, very few details about that the incident have come out yet. We have looked into the officer a little bit. We know that he has been on the Elmwood Police Force about 18 months, and he came from the Greene County Sheriff's Office, where he was a corrections officer. And I mean, his record at the Elmwood Police Department is there. He's only been there 18 months, so there isn't a whole lot there. There was a use of force incident that he was involved with, but it was he took a person to the ground as they were trying to flee police. He was found to be in compliance with all policies and procedures. So there doesn't appear to be any patterns of behavior or anything like that. So right now, I think we're probably waiting for the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office and Joe Dieters to likely make some sort of announcement in the next week, 2 weeks, who knows, about the findings of the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office investigation.
We're talking with Cameron Knight, a reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer, about a fatal shooting in Elmwood Place involving a man and a police officer. And just for our listeners' sake, the officer involved is Nicholas Arne. He's 25 years old. And the victim, or the man who was shot and killed, is Rodney Barnes. And he was 48 years old. Cameron, I know that you analyzed recently, and I think we had you on in the summer to talk about this, because deadly police shootings are obviously among the several issues that are top of mind in America right now. And you profiled the number of such deaths, such shooting deaths across our region since about 2015. How does this case compare to those others in the way that you as a journalist are able to obtain the information that you think is necessary to tell this full story?
Well, Elmwood Place is a very small police department. It's a very small municipality. Elmwood Place, the population there is about 2,200 people. The police department has 10 officers. And I think that, if anything, this shines a light onto those types of departments, because there are lots and lots of them. When people think of Hamilton County, they might think off the top of their head of Cincinnati Police Department, maybe Colerain, Green Township, the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. But there are between, I think, 30 and 45 police agencies, all independent police agencies in Hamilton County. And the report that I wrote over the summer that you're referencing basically found that in our region, and we define our region as Hamilton County, Claremont, Butler, and Warren counties in Ohio, the three counties in Northern Kentucky, and Dearborn County in Indiana. In our region, more shootings occur in smaller departments like that, than the big city department of Cincinnati. There have been 21 fatal police shootings since 2015 in our region, and more than half are made up by agencies other than Cincinnati Police.
Okay, and you mentioned that this is a situation that Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters typically presents the findings of the investigation of the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. He told you all at the Inquirer as of today that the process was still underway. Any indication?
Yeah, his office had no news today. We spoke with his office just a few hours ago, and there was no plans, no announcements coming out of their office planned for today at that point when we had talked to them, at least. Okay. But typically they do, the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office will handle announcing the findings of the investigation, unless it's Cincinnati Police. Cincinnati Police tend to coordinate more, do their own PR, basically.
Cameron, I mentioned moments ago that these types of shootings involving police officers are top of mind in this country because of the fatal shooting deaths of African Americans and the protests that followed mostly over the summer. Are you hearing any types of questions from community activists about this particular shooting and whether there might be moves to protest this one?
Right. So the Urban League did put out a brief statement, you know, notifying the public that this was an African-American man who was killed in Elmwood Place on Tuesday. Their statement was very general about the general trend of violence that faces the Black community regarding policing and these fatal shootings. Which is, again, like you mentioned, a topic that's very top of mind right now. So far, there has not been a lot of reaction in the community that we can find. We have not been able to locate any family of Mr. Barnes. We've tried. We've tried all of our journalistic tricks to do that, and we haven't really been able to find many people who knew him. The Hamilton County Sheriff's Office said he didn't have an address, which maybe implies that he's homeless, or maybe they're saying that because he was a fugitive at the time. It's really hard to say. So it seems like him being at a psychiatric facility implies there might have been a mental health issue, but that's completely unconfirmed. But we know that police involved violence and police involved use of force. There's a lot of discussion about mental health with that as well. So right now it's just very hard to kind of pin down and categorize this event as anything, because we just don't know very much.
Cameron Knight, reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. Before we let you run, Cameron, I want to talk a little bit more about Hamilton County Sheriff Jim Neal. You have a really lovely profile of him and his wife and the family that they've made official. What can you tell us about the two boys they've adopted?
Yeah, so they adopted a 6- and a 7-year-old yesterday. They finalized the adoption in a probate court yesterday. They've quietly been raising these two boys for years, which I found a little bit interesting. A lot of time public officials, elected officials, they put their family front and center. In this situation, probably due to the sensitive nature of what was happening, Jim Neal didn't do that. So this was sort of the first time that his family, untraditional family at this point, has come out and sort of made an entrance, so to speak. Based on what he told me, they had a relationship with the biological father of these boys dating back to like the 90s. They had this guy, the man who's their biological father. He stayed in their house for a while. They were a little bit older. He had just become an adult. He was like 18, 19, 20 years old when he stayed with them. He was just looking for a place to stay. Years later, he has some children of his own, and they become godparents, and they watch him every weekend. Second kid comes along, they have him every weekend, and then the parents run into some troubles, and they need a place for the kids to stay. And Jim and Kim Neal, Jim's wife's name is Kim Neal, took the boys in for a period of time, and then that turned into a more permanent situation down the road. And they adopted the two boys, finalized it just yesterday. So it was a pretty positive story in a week of relatively negative news.
You can read that story and see the photos that Cameron took to accompany it at Cincinnati.com. Cameron Knight is a reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. As always, Cameron, we appreciate the time you gave us on a Friday. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Mungs. Democrats in Ohio are hoping to pick up seats this year with climate on the ballot following the indictments related to House Bill 6. We've talked about that many times on this program. Let's talk about it now with Drilled News contributor Nancy Averett. Nancy, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. This is House Bill 6. We have discussed it many times with our friends from Ohio Public Radio, because ultimately a federal racketeering conspiracy indictment came down on former House Speaker of the Ohio State House, Larry Householder, related to $60 million in bribes. And first, I'm going to ask you to remind us all what House Bill 6 was before we discuss how Democrats are looking to weaponize it at the ballot box.
Sure. House Bill 6 was passed in 2019, and it was shepherded through the legislature by Householder. And it effectively propped up two nuclear power plants that are located along Lake Erie and two coal-fired power plants, that one is located in Indiana, in fact, and the other is in Ohio. And the bill also, in addition to that, I think it pumped about $3 billion into those industries. And basically through ratepayers paying subsidies. So the other thing the bill did was it reduced Ohio's renewable energy standards and energy efficiency standards.
And so now, because of the unpopularity of it associated with these federal indictments, Democrats are hoping to use it to their advantage. We've seen polls that show Ohioans do support overturning House Bill 6. We've seen politicians on both sides of the aisle suggest that that should happen. What do you see happening? Or I guess I should ask, what do you see Democrats doing this campaign cycle as it relates to HB 6?
So some Democrats, and actually some Republicans too, but some Democrats are who are running in, as you know, Ohio's an extremely gerrymandered state. So in many districts, Democrats have a heavy lift to get any traction when they're running for office. But if they can tie their opponent somehow to House Bill 6, they have a way. The public knows about the scandal much more than they really paid attention to the previous Republican scandal, which had to do with charter schools, thanks to Larry Householder's arrest. And the other thing is that, it's not a popular bill with the public. I'm not sure it really ever was, but it got pushed through the legislature anyway.
You talk to some of the Democrats that are running for legislative seats, and you've heard complaints from Democrats before that the legislative seats, the districts anyway, are gerrymandered to benefit Republicans. And so Democrats are already facing that obstacle. But what specifically are Democratic candidates saying in particular races about how this could benefit them?
Right. So one of the Democrats I spoke to, Craig Swartz, who's running against Bill Reinecke for a Senate seat. Reinecke was a co-sponsor of House Bill 6, so he's pretty strongly tied to it. And he took money from Householder, as did many, many candidates, money that came from First Energy, the company that owned the two nuclear power plants and the coal-fired plants. So he's been able to tie Reinecke very easily to House Bill 6. And he's challenged him. It's hard to do in-person campaigning these days, but he goes on Facebook Live and he talks about the fact that Reinecke hasn't returned money that he got from First Energy, campaign donations from First Energy. And some legislatures have returned the money, but he's made a big deal of that.
You note that Swartz says that he doesn't speak directly to the issue of climate change. Change. He tries to put it in a different type of context.
Yeah, I think, his Senate district is heavily Republican. And I think, unfortunately, that term climate change, for a lot of reasons, can be sort of a trigger word for Republicans. But as Swartz points out, if you talk about more nature and the outdoors, there's a lot of conservatives who value those things. And I think recent polls have shown more and more people are concerned about climate change, whether they want their candidates talking about it or not.
And you wrote, Nancy, that this particular Democratic candidate, Swartz, who lives in Upper Sandusky and is running for the state Senate as a Democrat, he says he told you he learned long ago as a Boy Scout to leave a campsite cleaner than he found it. And so that's the attitude that he would like to see people take towards the planet. He told you, quote, that's a value that transcends party lines. Republicans can relate to that because they are often hunters or into the outdoors. That's an interesting strategy.
Yeah, I think it's not a bad strategy for him. Swartz is very interested in energy as a whole. He has a lot of interesting ideas. He's really thought it through. I'm not sure that's true for every a candidate that's talking about House Bill 6, but he's really thought about.
Well, he recognizes what you just said. You characterized climate change as sort of a trigger term for opponents to Democratic policy. What did that particular Democrat tell you about the impact it's having? Did he see it moving the needle at all? Did he see people coming around to his perspective as he sort of recharacterizes the argument?
That is a great question. I'm not sure he has much of a sense of whether or not he's converting voters, but he did tell me that before the bill was passed, he was talking about it while the legislature was still debating it and trying to get potential constituents interested in it. And he said it was a tough sell. So at least now, since it's a household word for many Ohioans, when he mentions it, he said people's eyes light up a little. They know what he's talking about. So that gives him a little bit of leverage.
And this is Nancy Averett we're speaking with, a freelance journalist based here in Cincinnati. She contributed this article about Ohio's nuclear energy bribery scandal and its potential impact on the ballot to a relatively new publication called Drilled News. And Nancy, this is a publication that describes itself as investigating delay on climate action. Can we expect to read more of your work there?
I certainly hope so.
All right. Well, Nancy, we do very much appreciate you joining us this Friday. Thank you for your work and thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
And we'd like to address a segment that aired on this show on Thursday. We plan to preview the final presidential debate with surrogates from both campaigns, and we requested Ohio-based surrogates. And the Democratic campaign of former Vice President Joe Biden supplied us with State Representative Bridget Kelly, who showed up. The Republican campaign of President Donald Trump offered their own director of strategic communications, Mark Lauder. So we prepared to discuss the debate with Kelly and with Lauder. But 10 minutes before we went to air, the Trump campaign contacted us and let us know that Mark Lauder would not be joining us. Instead, Republican National Committee national spokesperson Liz Harrington would appear. So I had spent the morning preparing for a segment to feature Lauder, watching videos of his style and his talking points, which appeared to be reasonable and appropriate for our format here at WVXU. We had no time to prepare for Harrington. And what followed was an avalanche of vitriol from her, delivered at machine gun speed, and a segment that I let get away from me, and one that was not fair to the Democratic representative, Bridget Kelly, or to you, the listener. And naturally, we received a lot of emails, phone calls, and tweets. Some were supportive, and others were disappointed, to say the least, because that's not the type of programming you expect from us. It's not the type of programming we want to present. As always, we will learn when we mess up, and we appreciate you holding us accountable. Our region, like the rest of the country, is anxious as Election Day nears, and we regret feeding into that rather than offering the type of civil, smart, and informed discussion you've come to expect from us. We will do better in the future. We promise you that. But as always, our inbox is open to you for feedback on what you think about how we're doing and whether you think there's something we're not covering. And if you want to pitch some ideas to us, our email is available, talk@wvxu.org. That's talk@wvxu.org. You can always leave us a voicemail at 513-419-7100 or leave us a comment on Facebook. You can look us up on 91.7 WVXU or tweet us at 917 WVXU. I also noticed some of you like tag me in these tweets when you're disappointed in our performance at MICMONKS Media, Mike Monks Media. You can find me on there too. We can take it. We want to take it. So when you're happy or when you're upset with us, never hesitate to share that information. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. This theme music was composed by Rob Fetters. And you can find archives of every episode we've ever done, including yesterday's, on WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We will talk again on Monday.